Sin is a puppy that follows you home today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Not far from the epicenter of religious violence in Nigeria, a cottage industry is booming, romance novels. This woman heard about it from a friend.
She was like, you should read this book by this Muslim woman who writes romance novels called Sin is a Puppy That Follows You Home. And I was like, what?
That Sin sounds... is a Puppy That Follows You Home.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I heard the title, I was pretty hooked.
Plus, just how high does Donald Trump think the border wall should be?
He said the height should be 15 feet high. Then he went to 20 feet. And at one point, he said 35 feet high. It sounds like the more angry he gets at Mexico, the higher he wants the wall to be.
Those stories and more on the Panama Papers today on The World. Great to have you with us. When President Obama is confronted with news of attacks by extremists, this is often the tone he takes.
Our message to these killers is simple. We will find you, and justice will be done.
That's from last year after the Paris attacks. Obama then said,
terrorists like ISIL are trying to divide us along lines of religion and background. That's how they stoke fear. That's how they recruit.
So what happens when the extremists are defeated, but the hate they sowed in that place keeps on growing? We begin today with a story out of Nigeria that answers that question. The Nigerian military has scored some victories lately against the extremists Boko Haram, pushing them out of several towns it controlled. Nigerian writer Adobetricia Nobani traveled to the liberated town of Michika, where before Boko Haram, people of different faiths used to get along. But what she saw post-Boko Haram was not encouraging.
The Muslims and the Christians no longer can stand each other. They have different market days. The children insult each other in the streets, exchange hate speech, make snide remarks. There's just an obvious antagonism between the, or hatred and hostility between the Muslims and the Christians.
Yeah, just remind us how sad that is that markets are now on different days, one for the Christians, one for the Muslims, because markets are incredibly important social meeting points all across Africa.
Yes, especially for an agricultural community like Michika. The market day is supposed to be the most important day of the week. When people bring their produce from the farms and sell to people from far and wide, people tend to know the market days of each town, and they come on those days to buy the produce from the farms.
So you went to Michika with this interfaith group. You gathered the parties for a discussion in a ramshackle government classroom. What happened when all the people were asked to talk about their differences face-to-face and confront what's been going on in Michika for the past few years?
The men met in a separate classroom. The women met in a separate classroom. The young people, the town's leaders, and then the hunters and the vigilantes. The hunters, the professional game hunters and the vigilantes. And each group accuses the other of being Boko Haram sympathizers. And then we had the men, the women, explaining how things had changed. The women were complaining about how they were being asked by the Muslim women, being asked by Christian women, what do you have hidden under your hijab? The Christians say we're being treated badly. Just everybody had something to say about how their lives had changed. There was anger, there was tears, there was bitterness.
Do you think bringing them together, the Christians and Muslims and all these different kind of interest groups and parties, bringing them together was a bad idea? Was it counterproductive?
I think it was a great idea because, like a lot of them testified at the end of the meeting, it was the first time they had had the opportunity to come and sit down and even talk about these things. So they had people from outside mediating, people they could trust, people who they felt could listen to them without being biased. So it was cathartic in many ways. The fact that they shed tears, the Muslims and Christians together sitting in the same room, having people stand and say, this is what your behavior does to me, and watching people weep. Why are people asking me what I have hidden under my hijab? I knew you before Boko Haram came here. We were friends. I didn't care that they were Muslim and I was Christian. Why does it matter now? Why are these things dividing us? At least now they're conscious of how their behavior is impacting the next person and how destructive it can be.
Just at a personal level, Adobe, what is it like for you to be away from the headlines and be on the ground in the north of Nigeria and see all this for yourself?
It's always eye-opening and it's frightening because when I come back with these stories and I tell people in the south and, you know, people in the capital city, these things are so unimaginable. I sound like I'm telling tales, you know, like some colonialist who went to Africa in 1814 and has come back with stories of cannibals and, you know, naked people living in trees. That's how I sound. I have to convince people that these things are happening, and it's happening in our country. It's difficult even convincing my fellow Nigerians that these things are happening in our country. The horrific sight I see, it's just completely alien to the Nigeria in the South or in the capital.
What's really kind of confusing is just how horrific things were under Boko Haram and Michika, and why people then turned on each other when Boko Haram was chased away.
What we're seeing in Michika is the kind of thing that can happen in Europe and elsewhere in the world. If we assume that the devastation being perpetrated by the terrorists is something that all Muslims support. So that I think that's the mentality that is playing out in Michika. The Christians came back and thought, I mean, a man made a comment saying, because our Christian religion teaches us to be kind to people, they are taking advantage of us. So I think they saw it as an attack by the Muslims. So that is what happens when you see terrorism as an attack by Islam, as a Muslim thing.
Writer Adobe Trisha Nobani lives in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Her most recent novel is I Do Not Come to You by Chance. Adobe, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you.
Boko Haram violence has also touched Kano, the biggest city in northern Nigeria. And for a little stress relief, many of the women there like to turn to locally published romance novels. Photographer Glenna Gordon has explored this cottage industry in her new photo book, Diagram of the Heart. Gordon told me how a friend got her interested.
She was like, you should read this book by this Muslim woman who writes romance novels called Sin is a Puppy That Follows You Home. And I was like, what?
That sounds... Sin is a Puppy That Follows You Home.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as I heard the title, I was pretty hooked.
So how many people are writing these novels and who's writing them, women or men?
Well, there's a large reading industry and publishing industry in northern Nigeria. There's a strong tradition of local literature in Hausa, the language that they speak there, and that's widely spoken in West Africa. It's second to Swahili. This particular subset of literature is written mainly by women. There's, you know, action adventure books that are written more by men, and the books that I focused on for Diagram of the Heart and the women that I met are mainly writing this one subgenre called Lititafansoyeya, which is love literature. And they're books that are about love and marriage and all of the arrangements and family relations and politics that happen within those sort of confines.
Give us an example of one of the plots of these novels.
Sure. I mean, I'll tell you about Sin as a Puppy, since I already mentioned that one.
Right.
That is a book that's about a woman whose man takes a second wife, a co-wife, who it turns out is a prostitute. And it brings all sorts of problems into their house. And the wife ends up separating from the husband, the first wife. And she gets kicked out of the house with her children and has to sort of make do on her own. And she manages. She opens a restaurant and she starts making her own money. And in the meantime, her husband loses everything he has in a fire in the market where he has his goods and his money. And so the second wife leaves him. And then eventually she takes back her husband, but their power relationship has changed. And that's sort of the most important part. Even though it doesn't really look like a traditional feminist text in the way I might think of one, there has been a significant change in the course of the book.
That sounds like a pretty complex little plot there.
It is. I mean, it's by one of the writers who's sort of the most politically active and aware. A lot of the books are just sort of about like how to be a good wife and how to please your husband and about, you know, the poor girl who gets to marry the rich man. So there's a huge range in topics and in plots.
And all of this is happening in what is essentially a war zone. Was this happening before the conflict in the north?
There's a long tradition of literature in northern Nigeria and in Nigeria in general. I mean, Nigeria has produced some of the world's greatest writers. We don't know about a lot of the writers in the north because they write in Hausa and it's not widely translated. This sort of particular movement started, I mean, it depends when you count, but sometime in the past decade or two. You know, this is the Sahel. It's right below the Sahara Desert. And so it's a place where there's a lot of scarcity and there's been, you know, conflict for generations. And it's not a stable region.
Given how suggestive and even bawdy some of these novels are, what do the Islamic authorities make of them?
So the Islamic authorities do censor these books, and they were, you know, a little bawdier a couple years ago than they are now because of that. Recently, there were many books that were burned publicly, and the state governor at the time, who is now the Minister of Education in Nigeria, said they were contributing to moral indecency and corrupting the youth, and so made a very big public display of burning these books.
Glenna Gordon's new collection of her photographs is in a book called Diagram of the Heart. Glenna, it was really great to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glenna's photos are really stunning. If you want to see them, just head over to PRI.org. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump keeps insisting he wants a new border wall and that Mexico will pay for it. No way, says Mexico. And according to a campaign memo, if Mexico doesn't pay, Trump wants to cut off money transfers to Mexico. You know, the remittances workers here send to support their families back in Mexico. Reporter Frank Contreras is in Mexico City. I asked him if Mexicans are worried about this.
Absolutely. That captures attention here. One woman I walked by in the park, kind of enjoying the afternoon, I walked up to her, I asked her this question, and she stood up suddenly. She was kind of startled by the question. And she said, you know, my family gets remittances. She was an elderly woman. She says that it would definitely be a blow to her personal economy. And then she thought it through a little bit, and she just said, I think he's a little loco. So I think it really grabs people's attention. It shakes things up here. It makes people frightened a little bit.
So remittances, I mean, basically we're talking a fancy word for money that's sent back home. Is it fair to describe remittances as a financial lifeline for many Mexican families?
Yes, there are a great number of people who depend for their monthly income largely on remittances. And another way to think of it is, let's say you've got a grandma, she's retired, and she's got some kind of retirement fund, but you want to help her out. You know, she needs some medicine, like the old lady I was talking to in the park. So you send money from the United States into her accounts, and that's people taking care of family members. This is something that Latin Americans like to do, you know. It is a very important part of the economy. The Mexican Central Bank here is the institution that registers remittances. They say from 2015 to 2016, the amount of money that was sent, Marco, was around $25 billion. And that's around 2.5% of GDP here in Mexico.
Wow.
This is a big amount of money.
I gather remittances now account for more money than oil exports. So even the mention of it has got to really rattle Mexicans.
Falling oil prices, that affects Mexico's federal budget directly because a lot of that is projected on the price per barrel of oil. So Mexico always looks for other sources. And so it is a very important input to the Mexican economy. It's certainly one of the most important sources of foreign currency for Mexico.
Donald Trump said he would withdraw the remittance threat if Mexico makes a one-time payment of $5 to $10 billion to finance the wall. In 2009, the U.S. government said the cost of the wall at that point had been only $2 billion. Do we know if Trump has done the math on this?
Does not seem that way, Marco. When you start to look at the size of the border wall that Mr. Trump says he'd like to build, first of all, he doesn't seem to agree with himself on that. He said the height should be 15 feet high. Then he went to 20 feet. And at one point, he said 35 feet high. It sounds like the more angry he gets at Mexico, the higher he wants the wall to be. And of course, the higher you make a wall will require more cement, more infrastructure, more design, more planning. The kind of wall that he's talking about, it's probably impossible to put up a wall of that sort and not affect the tremendous amount of daily commerce that takes place between the United States and Mexico. So there's going to be a lot of interests affected. If that sort of thing ever becomes some sort of reality on the United States-Mexico border, from the Mexican viewpoint, it just sounds like a lot of rhetoric. I think a lot of Mexicans, the ones I speak to anyway, they're quite concerned that this could be a real blow to the bilateral relationship and trade going over the United States-Mexico border. And so all of that would be tremendously affected by this kind of campaign rhetoric that continues to go on here.
Reporter Frank Contreras in Mexico City. Great to have you on the show, Frank.
I'm glad to be with you, Marco. Thank you.
Up next, the Panama Papers, South Africa connection on the world. So the Panama Papers, that's a concise name for a huge, very complicated story. The massive document leak is exposing how the rich and powerful hide their money offshore, often avoiding taxes in the process. Okay, some people who follow the story say, fine, we know the rich do this kind of thing, and besides, it's mostly within the law. Well, here's a story that illustrates the actual human cost behind some of these complicated offshore banking deals. The Mossack Fonseca story extends to South Africa in 2007, and the biggest fraud that country ever witnessed. Reporter Aaron Conway-Smith in Johannesburg has looked into it for our Global Post team. And Aaron, according to the leaked documents, Mossack Fonseca helped set up offshore companies that were camouflaging money money that should have been death benefits for families whose husbands and fathers died in an accident in a South African gold mine a decade or so ago. Tell us about this one person in the center of the story. His name is Nick Hopa.
Yeah, so Nick Hopa was mentioned specifically in the reporting by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, or the ICIJ, that is behind the Panama Paper reporting. He was a 14-year-old boy living in northern South Africa when his father was killed in a gold mine accident. And his father and some other workmates at the mine were killed by chemical exposure. Mm. Now, his family had benefits thanks to a fund to help the widows and orphans of mine workers. So for Nick, along with his mother and a younger brother, they were getting by thanks to monthly checks from this fund. But then suddenly the monthly checks stopped coming.
Yeah, what was that about?
So what happened was that they were one of the victims. Actually, it was something like 46,000 widows and orphans that were the victims of this massive fraud by an asset management firm called Fidentia that had been basically looting millions from the funds, basically taking away the benefits that were helping these widows and orphans, and instead spending them on sort of lavish lifestyles and all sorts of fancy things.
Yeah, so what did we learn about Fidentia in the Panama Papers?
So basically, what we know so far is that Mossack Fonseca created offshore companies, offshore structures for two people that were jailed in the fraud here. But we don't know exactly how much money went where.
But we do know the money was being hidden. And we also know that Mossack Fonseca, this Panama City law firm, took fees of at least $59,000 from this Fidentia accountant after he was indicted. Can you clear that up?
Well, what we know is that after the scandal broke in South Africa, one of the two men implicated in the fraud here fled the country. And after it was sort of known that these dodgy dealings were happening, met with a Mossack Fonseca lawyer at a luxury hotel in Manhattan to discuss these offshore holdings, which was deeply, deeply suspicious indeed.
So J. Arthur Brown, the former head of Fidentia, was sentenced to 15 years in jail. That was 2014. Is there anyone else at this point who could be found criminally liable based on the Panama Papers leak?
No, the two people that are mentioned specifically, they're already in jail serving sentences. But the issue here is that there's been a huge effort in trying to recover some of the money that went missing and give it back to these widows and orphans who badly need it.
Yeah. Have the authorities been able to recover any of it?
They have been, but only a small portion of it. And so, you know, there is the thought that this potentially could help track down some of the money and get it into the hands of the people that need it.
Yeah, right. So let's return to the actual human cost of this. The widows and orphans who've needed this money, how have they survived?
It's been tough. I mean, there have been various reports over the past few years over some of them, not just Nick Hopa and his family, but we hear stories about women struggling to pay their children's school fees or having the electricity shut off because they can't afford it. There are thousands of widows and orphans that are continuing to struggle and would, you know, greatly benefit from getting back some of the money if it did, in fact, go into offshore accounts.
Aaron Conway-Smith in Johannesburg, South Africa, with the World's Global Post team. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
South Africa is the largest country in the southern part of the continent, but the other countries in what is known as Southern Africa have something South Africa does not, the Zambezi River. It courses through six countries, including Zimbabwe. The Zambezi also courses through this music by Zimbabwean band Mukumba. The name refers directly back to the Zambezi. Mukumba is the vibrant life experienced by Zimbabweans living along the river banks. Very cool stuff. Mukumba is currently on a brief tour of North America, and their stop at New York's Apollo Theater was fueled by the vibrant life along the Hudson River.
You know, coming from Victoria Falls and representing the whole of Zimbabwe as the band to play at the Apollo. You know, like it's a historic place to play there. The crowd really received our music.
That's Abundance Mutori, singer and bass player with Mukumba. The band was part of Africa Now, a showcase at the Apollo for up-and-coming artists from Africa. When Mukumba is not on tour, they live and work in their adopted home of Harare, Zimbabwe's capital. Urban life has added new elements to the band's sound, but its roots are still in their hometown of Victoria Falls.
Coming from a small town, which is Victoria Falls, with all the elements that it has, and becoming also a border town to other Southern African countries, is what makes also our music more, you know, different and interesting, because we are fusing also with all these other elements that we grew up listening to from these Pan-African sounds and fusing them with our own tradition and culture.
Zimbabwe today is so deeply associated with its leader, Robert Mugabe. I had to ask Abundance if Mukumba deals with political topics.
No, we don't talk about politics at all. We are like a band that wants to talk positive things, you know, about what we see around and also about things that affect youth as we are growing up and give some youths the hope, you know. So we don't talk about politics in our music and just want to entertain people to showcase of our culture. You know, we are about our culture, to show our culture to the whole world. This is what we are about.
There are all sorts of Zimbabwean musicians who have dealt with artistic oppression in their own way. Some, like Thomas Mapfumo, have left the country. Some, like Oliver Mutukudzi, stay and offer parables as political criticism. Mukumba steers clear of politics completely. But with songs like Yombe, they do delve into social issues. Yombe is advice from a parent to a child to be careful of HIV. Music from Zimbabwe's Mukumba, fresh off their date at the historic Apollo Theater in New York. If you missed their performance at Africa Now, we've got the next best thing. Back in 2014, Mukumba performed for KEXP in Washington. It's a really great show. We've got that video up on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI's The World. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Toronto, an unlikely duo teams up to help Syrian refugees. One is an imam, the other a rabbi.
There was a feeling in the air that we haven't had in years, that we were going together to do something really important. And both the imam and I spoke about saving lives, that that's what this is about.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here is something we've long known about ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. It has a sophisticated propaganda machine. Remember all those gruesome videos? But here's a new outlet for ISIS propaganda, an unofficial news agency called Amaq.
With the San Bernardino attack, we start seeing a pattern where a Amaq news agency claims the attack in the name of the Islamic State first. Very quickly afterwards, the pattern is now that an official Islamic State media outlet will claim responsibility on behalf of the group.
That's Rukmini Kalamaki, correspondent with the New York Times. She's investigated this news agency, Amaq, and its relationship to ISIS.
The working theory is that just like most states in the Middle East have an official news agency, so too the Islamic State is attempting to have a news agency that has the trappings of some level of objectivity in order to essentially give more gravitas to the release regarding their atrocities.
I mean, interestingly, Amaq breaks news sometimes, and other times it kind of stands back. Do you know why?
I mean, more and more we're seeing that Amaq seems to be the first place that news is released. So starting in December of last year, you have the San Bernardino attack, which was first claimed by Amaq. You also have the explosion that ripped through the Starbucks in Jakarta. That was also claimed by Amaq. Just a little bit more than a week ago, the Brussels attack was first claimed by Amaq. This seems to be the rhythm now. Amaq puts it out first, and then very quickly after that, you have an official release from the Islamic State.
Yeah, so who are the people who work for Amaq?
It's pretty clear that Amaq is the Islamic State. There's no question about it. Oftentimes, you'll see Amaq reporters who are embedded, actually, with ISIS units. And we know full well that no one is embedded with ISIS units unless you share their perverse ideology.
Right. So you say embedded in quotation marks because they're basically the same people.
You know, we don't actually know for sure, but the way I imagine it and the way analysts have described it to me is that they'll have these media operations throughout the territory that they control. It'll be in a cyber cafe, and they'll literally be sitting next to each other. So you'll have the Amaq reporter sitting on one computer, and right next to him, and it is a him, you'll have somebody who's working for Al-Hayat Media or one of the more official ISIS media outlets.
Why wouldn't ISIS just do like Al-Qaeda used to do? Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri would issue a video statement claiming responsibility. Why this veneer of objectivity?
I think because ISIS really takes its state-building project seriously, and they're trying to mimic the states that they know of. And the leaders of ISIS, as we know, are mostly from the Middle East. And in all of these Middle Eastern countries, you have a state news service. In Syria, you have a state news agency. And I think that is one of the accoutrements of the state. And I think that by creating this veneer of objectivity, they have actually confused even us, because for a long time, we didn't know what to call Amaq. You know, we were calling it semi-official news agency of ISIS, official, unofficial, you know. And even now, you know, I struggle with the wording because you do want to be transparent with your readers and make a distinction between Amaq and the actual organs of ISIS that they themselves have declared are part of their media branch.
Well, they've got this Al-Bayan radio station, ISIS does.
Right.
How
right.
does Amaq fit into ISIS's media empire?
ISIS has probably more than 24, and maybe even more than that, official media outlets. They have their own radio station, their own magazine. You have the Beak, which is published in English, Dar al-Islam, which is published in French. You have numerous video production companies, and then you have numerous channels on Telegram, this encrypted app on your phone, where they put out official statements put out by the Islamic State. Amaq is supposed to be in a slightly different space. So if you look at the language they use, they attempt to use more neutral terms. So whereas in an Islamic State press release regarding an event, they will refer to themselves, their fighters, as the soldiers of the caliphate, and they will refer to the people they killed, if they happen to be Westerners, as the kuffar or the infidel or the crusaders, right? In an Amaq press release, they will refer to the fighters as Islamic State fighters, and they will refer to the victims as members of the coalition, and they make a semblance of trying to use terminology that mirrors what a normal news agency would use.
But when you say claimed, it's really, again, that veneer of objectivity. They write it up
yes.
as if, you know, they're standing back and this happened and like an AP lead.
Yes, they try. It's funny because I used to work at the AP, so I'm calling it the, you know, ISIS's Associated Press wire. They even have, they're quite funny. I mean, they're even trying to put the trappings of a news organization with terms like breaking news. You know, they'll have a breaking news tab, exclusive, you know. They'll talk about their reporters being embedded. They're mirroring the terminology that we use.
And Rukmini, finally, how do you as a journalist use the news coming from this agency?
I know that when Amaq puts out something, if I can ascertain that X explosion or X a terrorist attack has been claimed by Amaq, to me, that's the same as saying the Islamic State has claimed it.
Mm.
So understanding the chain of custody of this pseudo news agency allows us to ascertain a claim of responsibility from the terror group.
Rukmini Kalamaki with The New York Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco, for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Here in the United States, there's been some resistance to the idea of admitting more Syrian refugees. Opponents say it could open the door to potential terrorists. Canada's refugee policy has also been criticized. A lot of Canadians want Ottawa to do more to bring Syrians into Canada faster. North of the border, private organizations are allowed to raise funds to help resettle Syrian refugees. And in Toronto, this has led to an unlikely partnership, as we hear from the world's Matthew Bell.
Temple Har Tzion was built in the 1970s on a busy boulevard in North Toronto. Around the same time, a mosque was built right next door. For years, the rabbi from the synagogue and the African-born imam from the mosque got along just fine. Then about 5 years ago, that Muslim congregation moved to a bigger mosque and a new one moved in. Its spiritual leader is a grand ayatollah from Iran. And that brought up some questions at Temple Har Tzion.
It wasn't anxiety, but there was we wondered, you know, will the politics be different?
Rabbi Corey Weiss calls himself a proud Zionist who supports Israel. So the question was, would this new ayatollah in the neighborhood share the same loathing for the Jewish state as the clerics who rule Iran?
With Jafri community that was here before, they were East African. And so there wasn't the Middle East politics to worry about. And so with the new community, we didn't know what to expect. So we actually tried to get together right away. And we did.
Leaders of the two communities met. Things were cordial, and they started working together on a shared issue, lack of parking. Standing in the lot between the two buildings, Weiss explains.
We have a system, so there's a connector down at the end there where the mosque lot and the synagogue lot connect to each other. Our office people share calendars, so we know when the Muslim holidays are and when their events are. They know when our holidays are and when we're busy. And when possible, we use each other's lots.
Weiss's counterpart at the green-domed Imam Mahdi Islamic Center is Grand Ayatollah Reza Hosseini Nasab. And together, they're getting more ambitious. The two leaders have teamed up to raise money for Syrian refugees planning to resettle in Canada. Nasab says the members of his mosque and Weiss's synagogue are on their way to raising more than $100,000, enough to support 4 Syrian refugee families for a year. Nasab was born in Iran. He came to Canada about 25 years ago, and he says Muslims have a religious duty to work for harmony in the country where they live.
We want the nation of Canada to be united and not to have the same problems that you can see in Middle East.
People still worry about those problems showing up in a place like Canada. Most Iranians in the Toronto area, for example, are Shia Muslims. And Imam Nasab says a few people at his mosque have raised concerns about helping people from Syria when some of them might be supporters of radical Sunni Muslim groups.
They know that the fighters in Syria and some of them in Iraq, they are related to Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Nusra, and they are very frantic and very dangerous for all of the world, including for the Shia communities everywhere.
Nasab says he's got faith in the Canadian government to keep dangerous people from getting into Canada. At the same time, he tells people to recognize that there is a human catastrophe unfolding in that part of the world and that people need to do their part.
The glorious Quran says a person who kills one person, it is like killing all the nations and all the people in the world. And if you save a person, it is like saving all the people in the world.
The same teaching is found in Jewish scripture, and that was the theological basis for Nasab and Rabbi Weiss teaming up to help Syrian refugees. Last month, they held a public event to announce their plans to raise funds, and Weiss says it was a beautiful evening.
There was a feeling in the air that we haven't had in years, that we were going together to do something really important. And both the imam and I spoke about saving lives, that that's what this is about. It was certainly one of my proudest moments as a rabbi and as a member of the Jewish community and as a Canadian, because this is a very Canadian thing to do.
Weiss says some members of his synagogue also expressed concerns about welcoming Syrian refugees to Canada.
Look, we don't pretend that Syrians have been brought up to love Jews. We know they haven't in general because of Middle East politics. And there are people who suggest to me that we shouldn't be doing this because why would you bring in people who hate you?
Weiss answers his own question by saying this is about saving lives. And if there's an opportunity to turn some enemies into friends, he says, that's even better. For The World, Matthew Bell, Toronto.
For any refugee, starting over is tough. There's a new language to learn, a new culture to figure out, not to mention finding a job, a house, and then for the kids, they're starting over in a new school. Beth Furtig reports now on how some Syrian refugee children are doing in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Aisha is 13, and 4 years after she and her family fled Syria, they're now resettled here in Elizabeth. She's trying to be a regular American student, but there's one problem. Aisha doesn't speak any English. That's where local tutors are playing a role.
So what you're going to say to her?
Please.
Dozens of volunteers come to the local library to help Aisha and other young Syrians with English. But a few kids said this warm reception didn't always extend to the schools. For Aisha, that's largely because she wears a headscarf.
They tell her, take it off.
That's Rena Shanawani translating. She's a Syrian-American who organized the library volunteers. Aisha told her that kids at her school wondered if she wore a headscarf because she's bald.
So one time she actually took it off and showed them that she does have hair, and she says, I can never take this off. I will never take it off.
Aisha laughs, but this incident wasn't the only sign of friction. When I met her father in January, he said all four of his children were still struggling in school because there were no Arabic translators. There's just not a big Arabic-speaking community in this part of New Jersey. The International Rescue Committee, which resettled the Syrians, has academic coaches who work with the schools and families. Spokeswoman Colleen Ryan says it takes time for everyone to adjust.
There's a ramp for communities to embrace and sort of integrate refugees from new places, but it's also experienced that over time, things work out.
But some of the Syrians still weren't satisfied. In February, they sent their kids elsewhere. Six of the Syrian kids, including Aisha, transferred to an Islamic school 25 miles away from Elizabeth. At 13, she's in fifth grade, 2 years older than many of her classmates, because she missed a few years waiting to resettle in the U.S. Despite this setback, Aisha says she feels much less stress than in the public school.
My mind is relaxed. Everyone is in hijab, and they help me. And the most important thing here is that there's like religion here. And I practice, and I don't forget.
The private school is called the Academy of Greatness and Excellence. It offered scholarships for Syrian refugees. So far, two Syrian families in Elizabeth have transferred their kids to the school. But while these children are now in a more comfortable setting, there are concerns about Syrian kids still struggling at public schools in Elizabeth. Rena Shanawani, who's been coordinating the volunteers, has been hearing their concerns.
Those children now have come into schools placed in grades based on their ages, but they really should be three grades behind or four grades behind. So part of what we are trying to do is advocate for the children in the schools.
We asked the Elizabeth School Superintendent, Olga Hugelmeyer, what's happening. In an email, she said the students take English as a second language classes. And while there are no Arabic translators, she said the district will translate student progress reports into Arabic for the parents. Now, it's possible that the schools might not always be aware of problems because the families are reluctant to complain. In January, a 7-year-old Syrian boy named Zain told us about kids bullying him and taking the sandwiches he brought from home. He only eats halal meats prepared under Islamic law. His father, who asked that we not use the family's last name, just consoled him.
If he took them from you, tomorrow I will buy you another one. I have to console him this way. In Syria, this kind of thing doesn't happen.
In Syria, the father explained, families also don't confront their child's teacher. But overall, he says he's grateful to be here, and both of his sons are still having an easier time than they had in Jordan. He hopes one will become a doctor, and he wants the other to join the army. For The World, Beth Furtig, Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Ripping the seams on Savile Row's glass ceiling. That's ahead on The World. It's the morning after in Wisconsin. Primary results are posted and the candidates have moved on. But in this Midwestern state known for its niceness, this unusually bitter presidential campaign has left some residents feeling unsettled. That's especially true for the state's 15,000 Muslims. Ahmed Qureshi heads the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. He says he sometimes feels like he lives in two different places.
We are welcomed in some places with open arms. And then, you know, you go to other places and you get dirty looks. It really has been increasingly a tale of two Americas, at least in 2016 politics.
I'd like to get a general sense of how things have changed politically for Muslims over the years in Wisconsin. I know it's hard to generalize, but wasn't it before 9/11, most of Wisconsin's Muslims voted Republican, yeah?
I would say that among the immigrant or the children of immigrants, they tended to vote Republican. You know, there was a certain aspect of the Islamic culture which is conservative in nature, and it was closer to the Republican agenda. However, that changed in the years after 9/11.
Now, I know you live in a western suburb of Milwaukee that's overwhelmingly Republican. What is it like politically, like your neighbors and your neighborhood?
Well, we live in a very nice neighborhood located close to a Catholic church, and we don't have any problems with our neighbors. But I can tell you, well, I'll just share this. The head of the neo-Nazi party in Wisconsin lives in my suburb as well.
What happened when you started building a mosque a few years ago?
There was one group called the Eagle Forum of Wisconsin that was organizing an opposition. Their leader at the time was saying, you know, we're not fighting against a religion. What we're fighting against is a tyrannical ideology, referring to the religion of Islam.
And I know you were at a public hearing when these opinions were expressed. You were in the back of the room. Well, what happened then?
That's correct. For every person that would get up and say something negative or trying to promote a fear or an irrational hatred, we would have not only Muslim speakers, but we had our interfaith supporters as well. And I would say that the support that we brought to those hearings was overwhelming, although there was, you know, some hate mongering that was going on as well.
Yeah, but despite that hate mongering, you managed to convince the community and they were amenable, right?
That's correct.
Last August, Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker speculated publicly that there are only a handful of reasonable, moderate Muslims out of, what, more than a billion Muslims worldwide who don't follow ISIS ideology. How did you respond to that statement?
I first brought this to the attention of other Islamic leaders in Wisconsin and then also to the interfaith leadership as well. And with their encouragement, I composed an open letter to Scott Walker asking him to clarify his statement. I said in the letter that, you know, I believe that he misspoke and that it was only a relative handful of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims who support terrorism, and the vast majority of Muslims are reasonable, moderate, and peaceful.
Did you get any response from the governor? Did you ever meet with him?
No, the governor's office said they would not have time to meet with me on the issue. Very disappointing.
Your father, I know, led a very different life in Arapur, Pakistan, before he came to the United States in 1953. He was an intellectual, a very learned man, I gather, who wrote poetry, and ultimately became a Green Bay Packers fan, yeah?
That's correct. And I've been myself indoctrinated for life as a Green Bay Packer fan.
Though you were born in Illinois, I think I'm detecting a Wisconsin accent now. I know Prairie Home Companion is over in Minnesota, but the civility and gentleness and earnestness is similar in neighboring Wisconsin. How does that civility influence your own community?
I think that the immigrants in this community, you know, they come from countries in which they actually are not able to freely practice the religion of Islam. the practice of the religion is even controlled by many states, you know, most of whom have been run by dictatorships that try to control the message. Here in this country, we have the ability to build our own places of worship. You know, we hire the imams that we want that fit with our communities. So we have a deep appreciation, and just as my father had an appreciation for the good things about this country.
Ahmed Qureshi, president of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Suits have never been my strong, you know, suit. If I were to pull the trigger, though, on a bespoke three-piece, within the world of bespoke suits, there is only one place I'd get it tailored, Savile Row in London. But don't take my word for it. Because all my clothes designer, dress smart like a London bloke. Yeah. Before he speak, his suit bespoke. And you thought he was cute before. Look at this peacoat, tell me he's broke. Take his word for it. Thank you, Kanye. The top tailors have set up shop on Savile Row for some two centuries, serving the rich and famous from Kings to Kanye West. But the owners of the shops have always been men. British Ghanaian designer Oswald Boateng became the first black man on Savile Row in 1994. And finally, today, a woman has her name above the door. That name is Catherine Sargent.
The first time I walked down the row, I just was so amazed by all the beautiful garments in the window. And I thought, oh my gosh, how do you learn to make those garments? I've never seen anything like that.
She took that first walk 20 years ago. Since then, Catherine Sargent has paid her dues, rising up the ranks at famed Savile Row tailor Gives and Hawks.
When I joined Gives and Hawks, there were very few women in the workrooms. You know, you're either a tailor or a cutter within the department. And I was really drawn towards the cutting side, cutting patterns and sort of executing the suit. And I became the first female head cutter.
Over the years, she's worked with celebrities like soccer star David Beckham.
I made a coronation uniform for a king.
Okay, David Beckham, a king. What will one of these suits run me?
We'll start at, say, about sort of $5,000 to $6,000.
And in this world of fast, disposable fashion, that is a small price to pay, says Catherine Sargent.
If you actually add up what you might spend on ready-to-wear garments over the years that a bespoke suit would last you, it's actually quite an economical investment.
Okay, fair enough. But I want to add that really,
who cares what they're wearing on Main Street or Savile Row? It's what you wear from ear to ear,
to ear,
and not from head to toe that matters.
You're never fully dressed without a smile. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, smiling, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
Hey, hobo man. Hey, Dapper Dan. You both got your style, but brother, you're never fully dressed without a smile. Your clothes may be Bo-Brummely. They stand out a mile.
PRI, Public Radio International.